it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm John McKenzie and I'm joined, as I always am, by my good friend and producer, Mike Zimmerman. Mike, how are you doing?
Well, we're back from international break, so I am doing very well.
Yep, there's lots of domestic football to look forward to. And one of the teams that a lot of people are looking forward to seeing how they develop is Tottenham Hotspur. And so we've spent this episode talking to a couple of guys who know a lot about it. So we have Charlie Eccleshare, who's one of the Athletic's Spurs writers. And we're joined by Nathan Clark as well from the Extra Inch podcast, a Spurs fan podcast. And so lots of expertise on the show today. But Mike, you've just listened to that conversation. What did you make of it?
I love getting inside of kind of the rebuild of Spurs. Once Harry Kane leaves, you bring in a lot of cash, but you also, you know, your talisman leaves. So you need to figure out a system with the players you have, plus bring in players that fit that system as well. You look at James Maddison coming in and really thriving under Ange Postecoglou. And then you've got other players stepping up as well. Richarlison has been playing well. Son has been promoted to captain, and he's been taking that leadership role. So I think it's fascinating to see all the different moving parts. Once Kane leaves, how then Spurs settle in and find their new identity?
Yeah, and we are recording this ahead of the North London Derby, so when this episode drops, we'll have a much better sense of where it is that Spurs are at. But I anticipate that there's lots to come still from Ange Postecoglou's Spurs, and so the best thing for us to do now, I think, is jump straight into that conversation. After the summer break finally came to an end, it felt as though the Spurs narratives were very much muted. Not only had Harry Kane finally left the club, but there was a new coach at the club. The squad was still in the inevitable post-Conte turmoil, and we were all being told to temper our expectations. We're now five games into the season. Spurs find themselves second in the table with no losses to their name. The fan base are reinvigorated, and Ange Postecoglou can do nothing wrong. So is this the sunlit uplands that lead us up into the beautiful era of Ange ball, or are we getting ahead of ourselves here? Well, fortunately, I have two guests with me today who are well placed to help me answer these questions. So firstly, one of the Athletic Spurs writers, Charlie Eccleshare, has had first-hand experience of the Postecoglouthion from his vantage point in the press box. Charlie, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
And alongside him, we have a Spurs fan and pundit, Nathan Clark. Nathan is a member of the Extra Inch podcast, a Spurs podcast, and is positively giddy with excitement these days. So Nathan, thank you so much for joining us too.
Thank you, mate.
So we're going to split this podcast into three sections. So we're going to talk about the expectations about this season coming into the season, and then what has happened so far this season in those five games. And I should say we are recording this before the North London Derby for context. And then a final section where we take a little bit of a look at the future. So let's begin with the good stuff. And I do want to celebrate the happiness, because Spurs fans haven't had a huge amount to cheer about for a number of seasons now. So Charlie, I'll start with you. What's it been like covering the Ange Postecoglou revolution as a Spurs writer?
It's been brilliant. I mean, the combination of really good football to watch and a really interesting person to listen to. Like, I wrote a piece the other week about him as an orator, and he's just an amazing speaker, really thoughtful person, has a hinterland. You know, sometimes press conferences can be pretty boring affairs with certain managers, and you kind of feel like everyone's going through the motions. And he's interesting because he sits there kind of, his body language suggests like, I'm not loving this. And yet he's so engaging in the way he talks. And his football has been similarly entertaining. It's been really great to watch, completely uncompromising as we knew he would be. And just so much change so quickly. Like, you look at so much, the way they're playing is so different. The personnel is so different. So yeah, so far it's been great and exceeded expectations already.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioning the word oration there, because Nathan literally said to me when we were coming into the record this, oh, I'd love to make sure we cover his ability to, Postecoglou's ability to talk about things. So yeah, Nathan, you've been pretty impressed both as a fan but also as a Spurs content creator, right? You must be loving this Ange Postecoglou era.
Yeah, I mean, On a sort of a personal level, yeah, I'm a Spurs fan. I've been a Spurs fan for a long time, but in the last few years, I made the decision to make being a Spurs fan my job, and that was pretty good for a while. And then in the last sort of 4 or 5 years, it's been difficult, right? It's been my job first, and I've been a fan second, and sometimes I felt so disconnected to the club, and then it's just a job. And I understand I'm very lucky that is my job, of course. But it's instantly come back, and I'm a Spurs fan again, and I'm up out of my seat screaming and loving that this is what I do.
Yeah, you mentioned on the Extra Inch podcast actually that you now feel more strongly about Ange than you did about Poch.
yeah, I kind of do, man. It's like, yeah, I'm suddenly aware that this podcast has a bigger audience than mine, and I'm suddenly sort of a bit vulnerable. But yeah, On the topic of his oration, as well as his football, which is fantastic, I feel like most football coaches, all football coaches really, are like obsessed workaholics who have spent their entire lives nearly inside football and have had their entire perceptions of reality warped by football, that a lot of them haven't really matured as adults, right? as a tactics nerd, I feel I could probably have a football conversation with most football coaches about football, but I feel like really only Postecoglou could I have an adult conversation with about non-football topics. I just feel so proud to have someone who speaks so well on not just football, but we're going to obviously talk about later, with regards to mental health, with regards to the use of a concussion substitute for Romero a couple of weeks ago, and so many other topics. I am really kind of infatuated with Ange, and it's been 5 games, and that's kind of crazy to say, right?
Yeah, and I think, again, before we get into what happened over the summer, it is worth talking about the aspect of good vibes, because I think that's so important for any manager coming into a new job. So, yeah, Charlie, how much of Postecoglou's success so far has come down to getting the balance just absolutely right in terms of getting the respect of the team, but also the fans as well?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. Generally, that balance between how much it is about the kind of vibes and the feel-good factor against, you know, how much it is just him being really tactically smart. But yeah, starting with the vibes, I suppose. Like, the sense I get from people at Spurs is that he was helped in a way because of what happened last season. The players were just like really up for something different and maybe more willing to embrace something new. If, say, he'd come and replaced Pochettino, that might, you know, that would be very different. As it was, we know that the players were, you know, pretty unhappy last season. And so I think that helped with them being like, okay, well, this might seem very different, but actually we quite want something very different. I think he's just, with his empathy and honesty, the way he treats people, it's quite easy to buy into quite quickly. And I think he, you know, what's so important as well is that he matches the rhetoric with his actions. So it's all well and good coming in and saying, no, it's a clean slate. You know, everyone's got a chance to impress me. If you then just go and pick the tried and tested. He's come in and like ripped up the leadership group from last season. You know, Højbjerg's not starting games. Dier was not getting in match day squads. Lloris is the third choice keeper. So he has been true to his word. And he said on that, on the tour as well, you know, I don't really care how young the players are. I don't care that you might think this is quite risky. You know, he was asked like, oh, you know, could you play Udogi and Porro? Because I think for most people that filled them with a bit of terror. He was kind of like, fuck yeah. You know, like, I'm really excited by that prospect. That sounds amazing. And so I think that's just set the tone, that he has been true to his word. And that's meant all the players have bought into it, knowing it's a genuine meritocracy. And from speaking to people who used to play with him, they will say that you are just more likely to go above and beyond for a manager who, A, you like as a person, but B, you like their training sessions. They're enjoyable, mm-hmm. rather than if you're kind of pushed to just do the same thing week in, week out, that you don't really enjoy a huge amount.
Have you got the sense from being around the club that that's had a knock-on effect as to how the whole club is being run now?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think over time you would hope that would have an effect. I definitely do think that it has a knock-on effect, like with the crowd. There's this like weird triangulation between manager, players, and supporters. And I think, Nathan, you'd probably agree, over the last few years, there's been not a lot of effect. It's rare that they've all been working in harmony. We probably haven't seen that since Pochettino. Whereas I do think that, you know, that the way he's treated his players, the fact that the players have bought into him, that's then fed into the crowd perception, and then you just see like on Saturday just how bought in everyone was. I think that makes an enormous difference.
Nathan, you've already described yourself as a bit of a tactico, and obviously good vibes don't often go well with people who consider the game from a tactical point of view. But what's your take on that aspect of it, how important those good vibes are in order to get the tactical ideas across and get everything moving in the right direction?
Yeah, I mean, it's very circular, right? You need the buy-in from the players. You need to give them some kind of inspiration, especially when you're sort of a lesser known coach, so Postecoglou was coming in, and you want that kind of buy-in. But also, playing really good football and winning football matches is the best thing you can do to improve the vibes, right? Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, you're talking about buy-in a lot there. So from buy-in to buy-in.
Okay, well done.
I promise you that's the only bad segue I'm going to do in this podcast. But yeah, we need to talk about Harry Kane. Everyone's talked about Harry Kane all summer long. I'm not that interested in talking about whether or not Spurs are better or worse without Harry Kane, because I think, you know, it's obvious that you're going to be a better team if you have Harry Kane in your team from that point of view. So we could debate Ewing theory till the cows come home. But I think what I'm more interested in is, again, following on from what we've been talking about, Charlie, before you mentioned the fact that Postecoglou was able to tear things up, and in many respects, getting rid of Kane was like the first cut, right? The first cut is the deepest, but it allows the club to reinvent itself to a degree, right?
Yeah, I think it's quite an interesting counterfactual if Kane had stayed, because I don't think they would have made as many signings as they did. You know, low key, they made 7 signings in the summer. It felt like a window where they maybe didn't make as many signings as they could have done or should have done. But I think that was partly because Kane left that you expect there needs to be such a big overhaul. You know, without him going, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Would Maddison have come in? You'd like to think so and you'd hope so, but possibly not. And, you know, he Postecoglou was aware there was a very, very decent chance Kane was going to go. So obviously needed a creative player. It would have been really exciting to see them play together. But it's definitely, I think, created a unity in some ways, not in an anti-Kane way, but just in a, well, we really need to front up now. Kane's gone. Who's going to step up? Everyone's writing us off. What have we got? You know, it's quite a good way of creating that sort of siege mentality in a way. And I think he's channeled that very effectively because he's tasked other players with stepping up. And, you know, you look at Son becoming captain, Maddison, someone like Romero, who's now a vice captain, who's improved so much this season. So I think all of those things have come together and he has managed to turn it into a positive rather than a kind of woe is us, we've lost our best player. I mean, as I said at the time, can you imagine Mourinho or Conte, if they'd been the manager when Kane had been sold, they just would have been absolutely furious, you know, and thinking of the injustice of it all. Whereas his view throughout was very much, it's just a different challenge. We've now got to rise above.
Mm. You mentioned there that there's been a lot of transfer activity. Nathan, I'm interested in your thoughts on the club's activity, because we all knew that the squad was going to require a huge amount of work in the wake of the fact that Antonio Conte plays with generally a back three system, and that means that you push the squad in a certain direction. And obviously no team is ever going to do as much business in the summer as their fans want. So I guess looking back on it now, you've had 5 games to watch. Do you think that the club did a good job? Did they do as well as could be expected in light of the transfer window?
I do think they did a good job. I don't think they did as well as they possibly could have done, right? I mean, I'm always going to kind of think that to a degree, and any fan is, as you say. But I think to Charlie's point about how 7 came in and it didn't seem that way, it's like there was this early phase where we did the sort of the obvious stuff that needed doing, right? We need a goalkeeper regardless of who the coach is. We need a centre-back regardless of who the coach is. We need James Maddison regardless of who the coach is. And we did that. And then there's a long break where are we going to sell Kane or are we not going to sell Kane? And then there's sort of the bonus round at the end, right? And it's that sort of ancient history what happened at the beginning of the summer already. So the club, and Charlie can help me out here, but the club have sort of upped their talent ID by sort of bringing third-party help in terms of analytics-based scouting, which is something I've been calling for Tottenham to do for nearly a decade now, right? And I think that our talent ID has evidently dramatically improved. We've brought in a brilliant goalkeeper. We've brought in a brilliant centre-back. But I do think that the squad building isn't quite there yet. So whilst the individual targets we're very good at, the overall picture, we've maybe missed steps. So we obviously, and you made a video on this, John, we obviously needed a 1v1 specialist winger. Early in the summer, we picked up Manus Solomon on a free, which in isolation is good business, right? But he used up a non-homegrown spot in the squads. And then later we went, we kind of actually still need a first Devon quality winger. Who's the best homegrown winger on the market? Oh, it's Brennan Johnson. And somewhere between those, we've used up two squad spaces, one of which is non-homegrown, and spent shy of 50 million on transfer fee, where maybe we could have been more efficient in how we did that. None of this is too surprising when there's not an official director of football at the squad, right? But as much as I can critique that, overall, talent ID is much stronger. And more importantly, probably, we have a coach who coaches players and is getting the most out of both the players who were in the squad already, those who were out on loan, and the ones that have come in. And that will just really maximise anything we do.
I also think having a manager in for a decent amount of time should help avoid the sort of situation where you've got various different managers signing players they want and then create, you know, you look at like all the different right backs that they signed under different managers, and also having in, hopefully anyway, and to your question before about whether Postecoglou has kind of changed how the club is run, it's absolutely fundamental that Postecoglou is aligned with whoever comes in as director of football. Because you had a situation under Conte where you had Paratici, who generally wanted to sign kind of younger players who'd have sell on, and Conte, who wasn't really bothered by that. And I always think back to last summer, Spurs signed two left wing backs. One was Ivan Perisic, one was Destiny Udogi. One was 19, one was 33. Completely different profiles. And in one sense, you can say, well, you know, that's fine. It's okay to have, you know, a bit of variety in your squad, but I also think just spoke to how there really wasn't alignment between those two, and you could see therefore why Conte was getting frustrated on one hand. Paratici, it's probably not ideal for him, and so you'd hope that the squad building will be better when they are all aligned in what they actually want from the players that come in.
Did you feel as though the club were happy with their business this summer?
I'm told Postecoglou was. I know on the last day that there was you know, talk of other players coming in, like Conor Gallagher, and in the end it was just Brennan Johnson. But yeah, I was told he was pretty happy. And, you know, I think he sets the tone. I also wonder the extent to which he is more, I don't know, he's very demanding in lots of ways, but I don't think he's like some managers that if he didn't get in all his targets, he'd kick up a massive fuss. I think he's better at working with what he has. As Nathan says, it's been a while since Spurs have had a manager who's so committed to coaching the players and improving them. I do also think it's been suggested to me that maybe you need to think about this window not completely in isolation, because it's, you know, we saw with the Bale 7, I think the mistake they made there was trying to do everything in one window. And it's very, very difficult to do that, especially when A, you're selling a player right at the end of the window, and B, every club knows that you're suddenly flush with a huge injection of cash. So I think we'll need to judge, you know, if the window that's just gone isn't built on, then I'm sure Postecoglou and many supporters will be frustrated by it. I think the idea is, you know, in January they can have a look again at some players. We've reported Ivan Toney as someone who's of interest to them. Maybe he becomes available in January and then next summer. Like, it's boring, but it is a process. I know people hate that word, but it is kind of true.
One more question in this section, because by the end of the summer there's a fair amount of expectation setting about Spurs' season, and I think understandably so, given the fact that so much had changed. We talked about Harry Kane leaving, we've talked about trying to rebuild the squad in a completely different image of a completely different manager. It's tended to be the case that most people were saying, you know, you're going to have to bear with this. Postecoglou's football isn't going to just emerge overnight. And Postecoglou's football emerged overnight. So, yeah, I'll start with you, Nathan. How surprised were you that these ideas took hold? Because I know you were definitely saying, you know, we're going to have to take time on this one.
Yeah, I thought it would take a while longer. I think, basically our slow start was the Brentford game, and then that was it. We'll never lose again. I think my concern was the defensive game for multiple reasons. I guess sort of the surface level element of we're going to play really attacking football despite not having a talent domination situation over our league like he did at Celtic, although he didn't have at Yokohama. And then the two of us have talked at length before about his pressing system at Celtic. So for me, I noticed that the centre-backs are often quite some way off supporting the counter-press, and there was a bit of space there in front of the defenders. But then he did have the profile of two passive centre-backs at Celtic, whereas Romero was maybe the most aggressive centre-back in the world, right? And then the other thing that you pointed to my attention, John, is how when they press in a 4-4-2 shape, the two forwards tend to commit onto the opposing two centre-backs, leaving the pass into the midfield. And that was a big concern. I thought that was going to take quite a bit of time, that we would be, yeah, we'd see lots of sort of 5-4 score lines, right? But almost straight away, adaptation there, changing shape, being a bit more sensible, not pressing the goalkeeper at every chance to do so, which has been really, really impressive. I think that perhaps in the expected goals, you will see something closer towards that expectation, which is an odd word to use there. But that's already calmed down quite a bit, I think. And the football itself speaks to the quality that we have on offer, both in and out of possession.
Mm. What about yourself, Charlie? Because you've obviously been in the stadiums watching these games. So
yeah, it is funny because everyone who covers Spurs or, you know, wanted to find out more about Postecoglou was able to look in their eyes very wise by saying, look, he starts slowly. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. There are going to be some teething issues. And then obviously they've come out absolutely flying with 4 wins and a draw. I do think that period, you know, that will happen. There will be a period where, you know, new manager bounce is a thing. I know it's normally you talk about it mid-season rather than at the start of the season. But yeah, as Nathan was kind of joking at there, it's not going to be completely plain sailing. So I think they probably will have a challenging period at some point, maybe once teams become a bit wise to it. There might be an extent to which teams aren't, you know, totally sure yet how to deal with this Spurs team. But partly for that reason, it's massively exceeded my expectations. Yeah, they look so much more coherent. They look a lot stronger defensively than I was anticipating. I thought there would be games, and I think there will be those games, the 5-4s, as Nathan says, like maybe not quite to that extent, but I think there are going to be games that are a bit chaotic, and there are going to be games Spurs lose because they're too exposed and they get criticised for that. But it's been really impressive how quickly a lot of the players have taken to what's been asked of them. You know, someone like Pedro Porro, who I think a lot of people were sceptical about what he'd be like as an inverted fullback, I think he's been really, really good. Someone like Destiny Udogi, who was highly rated, but he never played in the Premier League, has come in and has been absolutely fantastic. So, yeah, it really has made a mockery of that early caution. But I guess as well, there is the thing of, A, it's a teeny sample size. B, the fixtures have been fairly kind. And, yeah, we record this before Arsenal and then Liverpool. And I think everyone is just so curious, like, you know, it's like reading a book. They just want to read the next chapter and find out what happens, because I think it will be quite revealing one way or the other.
Mm. Yeah, there's a smile from Nathan there. I'm sure he can wait for the next chapter. But let's move on to talk about what's happened so far this season, the games itself. We've seen all the results so far. You mentioned a fairly nice schedule. So a 2-2 draw with Brentford, which you described as the sort of slow start, Nathan, followed by wins against Man United, Bournemouth, Burnley and Sheffield United. How important was that run for getting the Ange project off the ground, Charlie? Do you think it was, you know, the fact that those games were maybe, I mean, looking at the Manchester United game, you don't think of that as being like a nice, easy game to get going, but it proved to be a good test without being so difficult they couldn't pass it, right?
Yeah, it was kind of ideal in some ways. It's a big name, but it's a big name but a team that's quite flawed. Yeah, I think that's helped, although it's interesting speaking to people at Spurs, because they are also quite excited by the idea of playing teams who are going to attack them and that they can break on. And obviously Arsenal will be so interesting in that respect, because it's two teams who love to dominate the ball, dominate territory, and Spurs will be able to play in a slightly different way. You know, Saturday against Sheffield United brought a different challenge in that it was a team that only wanted to defend, wanted to waste time, all of those sort of things. But I think, you know, a game like Burnley away felt like that played into Spurs' hands quite nicely, because it was a team trying to do not totally dissimilar things from Spurs, but one that wasn't as good as them, didn't have as good of players, so left themselves quite exposed. You know, Brentford was and is a tough game away from home. You know, they're very good at sitting deep and closing the spaces. But yeah, I think, you know, it's the sort of run where you can build a bit of momentum. And yeah, it does mean then you have a kind of cluster of difficult games, as Spurs have now. And then at the end of the season, they've got a really sort of horrible run at one point. But I guess we just don't know this. You know how some teams sort of develop a knack of being really good against good teams? Some teams like Manchester United have got this run of being awful away at good teams. So I think it'll be interesting to see sort of where Postecoglou's Tottenham fall on that spectrum.
And Nathan, from a tactical point of view, what has Ange Ball looked like for Spurs so far?
What has Ange Ball looked like? I guess like the overall picture is, okay, you've got a possession side here and an attacking team, and what that means in modern football is some sort of derivative of Guardiolian football, right? And that's sort of become its own kind of meme within Tottenham. But I think what differentiates Postecoglou from Guardiola, Arteta, company, Tuchel, is like a sort of dynamic movement. And what I mean by dynamic is like constant adaptations. Obviously, all of those teams, they will swap players around. They'll have rotations between those players, keeping the spaces occupied, but changing the personnel in those various things as the game develops. I'm trying to avoid using the word sort of free or freedom or even fluid, because those can be misleading. It's more sort of an act of live problem solving, where if Maddison wants to come towards the ball and build up, and Udogi pushes up into that kind of space, he's not just going to do his best James Maddison impression. He's going to say, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to be a threat towards the box. And James Maddison isn't going to be Udogi in the left-back position. He's going to look to be a playmaker and dictate the game from that position and things like that. And then there's not a great fear, whereas you would have with those other coaches I named, of sort of doubling up in a position. Yeah, we've got two players out on the wing together. That's not a huge problem. We don't mind. We're not really losing too much when that happens. So I mean, it's tempting right now to be like, oh, this is an evolution of the previous ideas, and I don't want to get carried away with that too much. But basically, that's how it feels right now.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing you talk about it like that, because for me, Postecoglou is within that school of tactics that Marcelo Bielsa is in, which is a sort of mix of, you know, Guardiola, like the really patient positional stuff, but it does have that dynamism as well. It is about, even when it comes to inverting the fullbacks, it's inverting the fullbacks in order to build up play and give yourself a little bit of cover in case you lose the ball. But the idea is always to get the ball forward, get it into that front line, get them in dangerous positions where they can create stuff. And I think the result is really quite nice. It's good to watch the football, right?
Yeah, it is, and it's interesting you saying, Nathan, there about the word freedom, because I put that to Maddison after the Bournemouth game, where it looked ostensibly as though he had a pretty free role. You know, he was popping up all over the place. And Postecoglou was quite keen to say, it might look like freedom, but it's not. You know, these are all... Because I think sometimes those managers can bristle a bit at the idea that it's all sort of free-flowing and people just go where they want. Like, you can only play in that kind of way if you're very, very carefully regimented. And one of the great sort of misinterpretations of Mourinho, for instance, people thought he was very regimented. In an attacking sense, he wasn't. And that was the problem, was that he kind of didn't have attacking patterns. It was more just, you know, he was used to a period of football where you could kind of say to certainly the elite strikers, you know, just you sort of go out there and express yourself. You know, that used to be how football worked to some extent. So, yeah, that sort of mirage of freedom is, I think, what a lot of the best attacking managers do. And even, and I working on a piece on Romero and use that word and then did slightly regret it, because again, it's probably the same thing, that he has license to get forward and pop up in these attacking positions, but that will be safe in the knowledge that someone else is going to cover for him, or that it's a pattern of play that's been worked on.
Yeah, it's funny, I've just made a video talking about actually Fernando Diniz and Guardiola and the big debates that exist between them. And freedom is a big buzzword in those debates, because it's, you know, there's this idea that some managers allow their players freedom and other managers curtail those freedoms. And, you know, Jack Grealish must be sitting at home totally, all day being like, I'm not able to be the person that I want to be. But I think, you know, there's plenty of different accounts of freedom available out there for you to borrow from, philosophically speaking. And some of those accounts of freedom say, you know, sometimes systems allow you the freedom to go beyond, you know, this idea of the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. That's a concept of freedom, albeit one which is very much about, you know, actual regimented ideas, as you were saying, players having principles in their head that they know if they follow, then good things will result from them as well. So I don't know if either of you got any thoughts on that's gone a little bit philosophical, but
no, definitely. Definitely, sorry, Charlie.
No, I was just going to say, I think Guardiola is, in my mind, always the kind of who comes to mind, yeah, when I think about that debate, because he is someone who, because I think that the narrative kind of flipped with him a bit. People did think early on in his career, because they were so good to watch, that they were this incredibly free-flowing team. Then it went full circle and everyone was like, actually, they're too regimented. You know, there's no room for an Ibrahimovic in the team or whatever. And the way City play now even, I think people, there is something quite clinical, quite surgical. You know, he found a way, if I think back to that like 17-18 title-winning team, it was a little bit, sometimes felt a bit computer gamey. You know how you could just find a way to score? There were kind of glitches in the game. And they seem to have found that with a kind of pass in behind to a winger who would then cross low for the other winger to tap in. But yeah, and Grealish is a great example of that. Someone who at first it did feel like he was going to be sort of stymied by this too sort of systemic way of playing to now thriving in it. And I think, yeah, you only have to look at how the players have adapted to what Postecoglou wants, see that you can have a huge amount of enjoyment and apparent freedom, even if that is done within certain structures.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think anyone's accusing Postecoglou's football of being, you know, miserable and not enjoyable. So you've talked there about the players, you know, adapting to the system. One of the players who has adapted to the system quite well, and you mentioned already, Charlie, was Pedro Porro, who there was a lot of debates about whether or not he would be able to fit in the system, because as we've said, Ange likes to invert his fullbacks, so his fullbacks have to do a certain amount of build-up work, they have to do a certain amount of defensive work. And Nathan, you were unsure as to Pedro Porro's fit going into the season in that fullback role, but it seems as though he has changed your mind on things. So what was it that changed your mind about him as the inverted fullback?
I mean, yeah, wow. I was sure that he couldn't do it. because for me, Pedro Porro, a fantastic technical talent, but in my opinion, sort of the wildest decision making you could expect a fullback or a wing back to have. Looking at his performances for Sporting, just constantly losing the ball whenever he received it deep, always trying things to the extent of, like, and even when he didn't lose the ball, he's like taking on three players in his own half when there are passes open to him. And I look at that player, and that materialised at Tottenham as well under Conte, and I think, okay, maybe this guy could play on the wing, you know, because he can be out on the touchline. He's a tremendous crosser, but he's not really a two-way player, so he's restricted there. And I sort of wrote him off. I thought that's not going to work out. And that Emerson Royale would have that place, but very, very quickly, Porro's decision making has completely 180'd overnight, and that is maybe that's a misread from me on Pedro Porro and his limitations, but I think probably it's more of a testament to Postecoglou's coaching.
It almost comes back to what we were talking about with freedom before, right? Maybe he's now in a system which allows him the possibility to make those decisions, which make him a better player overall. But you mentioned that you'd be impressed with Porro.
Porro is a really interesting one. After the United game, so Porro didn't start in the game at Brentford, and then he came back in against United. So they did line up with Udogie and Porro for the first time. And yeah, I think there are a few hearts in mouths. And I rewatched that game. At the stadium, I hadn't really thought a huge amount of Porro's performance. I thought he'd been okay, but I hadn't thought loads of it. And then I rewatched it, and he was so impressive. And it partly, because Gary Neville on Sky Sports comms was really getting into him. I think because, you know, there's such a distrust of any change in football, and especially as a former fullback. I think he's clearly very sceptical about the idea of inverted fullbacks, clearly had it in his head that Porro couldn't do this role. And sure enough, Porro did give the ball away a couple of times. But in amongst that, he did so much good stuff. He was so important to the way Spurs built up. Spurs' first goal came from him making an interception, and then rather than just smashing up the field, which probably a lot of people wanted him to do, he waited, played a really nice pass to Richarlison. They went and broke and scored, and he was again then involved from a central area in the build-up. So after that, I was like, okay, maybe, again, like we've come in with such preconceptions about him. Maybe he is more suited to this role than most of us thought. And I think since then he's just sort of settled down into it. Lovely turn he did on the weekend against Sheffield United, where he takes the ball in a kind of inside right position, loses the opposition player. And yeah, I think he's adapted to that extremely impressively, especially as there is someone in Royale who, as Nathan says, I think most people thought was a more natural fit for that position.
Another area that has been talked about a lot since Ange Postecoglou arrived has been the wide forward area. And you mentioned, Nathan, before that a big question during the summer was whether or not Spurs were going to get a really elite two-way winger who could cause problems from those areas. And I think if any area has been the area that has maybe raised the most questions so far with the season going on, it's been that area, because there's a number of different players who can play there, all of whom seem to have different skill sets. So we've seen Kulusevski play there, we've seen Brenn Johnson brought in to play there, we've seen Perisic, we've seen Son, we've seen Manor Solomon as well. Loads of different players and being moved in and out interchangeably. Charlie, what's your take on the wide areas in terms of who fits best there and who you think Ange thinks is going to be the longer term solution in those areas?
Yeah, it has been interesting, and I definitely felt in the first few games that what Spurs were doing very well was, because obviously part of the reason for inverted fullbacks as well is that you get your winger isolated, but that sort of lives and dies by how good that winger is, because it's not easy often being, you know, yes, it's great being one-on-one with a fullback, but that can mean that you're doubled up on, and, you know, it's asking a lot of where you're at, both with your confidence and your ability to take on a man and beat them. And in that United game, I thought Kulusevski, quite often they did open the space up for him, but then he wasn't really, you know, he might win a corner or that sort of thing, but he wasn't kind of explosive. And I thought this system could really explode if they are able to have two wingers who are just flying. You know, and if you think back to Son and Kulusevski at the back end of that 21-22 season when they got top four, the way they were then was on another level, I think, even to where they are now. And Kulusevski's coming back into good form, but he's not quite there yet. I do think that is still an area that, you know, if Kulusevski can really click and get back to those levels, I think that will make an enormous difference. Brennan Johnson, I don't really know. I've not seen enough of him to be able to confidently say one way or another how good he's going to be. I kind of trust that he'll be pretty good. You know, I think Postecoglou's judgment is usually pretty sound, but I haven't seen enough of him firsthand to definitively say. Son, as a wide forward, we know how lethal he can be, even though last season when he was carrying an injury, he wasn't so good. But I think it will be those three largely who share those two positions. I know Solomon's got the shirt at the moment, and I think he's looked good. But I'd be surprised if he was kind of a regular starter as the season went on, personally.
Yeah, and so much of this comes down to the fact that, as you said, the whole system is designed to get players into certain positions and then benefit from those positions. If you don't have the players in those positions who can benefit from those positions, those scenarios, means that you end up with this situation where you're like, well, what's the point of this? So, Nathan, I know you've got a lot of thoughts about this. So, yeah, what's your take on it now? Because I guess a lot of this hangs on what you think happens with Son, right? Because Son started out on the left, has been moved inside to play as a striker, and I guess that then raises questions about what you do if you are going to use Son in certain games as a striker in those wide areas, right?
Yeah, I think with Son specifically, if you play him out on the touchline, he doesn't quite have the pace he used to have. He's not really the 1v1 specialist. Maybe he was for a brief while in his sort of mid to late 20s, but he's not the 1v1 specialist that you want in that position. And you're really kind of denying him the opportunity to get into goal-scoring positions, which is by far his best attribute, right? So for me, he always kind of made more sense as the forward. I think he profiles somewhat similarly to Kyogo at Celtic anyway. So I wasn't too surprised that that's where he's ended up. And obviously, he's now rotating with Richarlison. Kulusevski, yeah, I mean, it's funny because there was this sort of infamous tweet from a Juventus fan about Kulusevski's inability to beat his man 1v1 and how through his time under Conte, that seemed like a ridiculous thing to say, because he was regularly putting up multiple dribbles and turning those dribbles into goals and assists. But I think that a lot of the time in those scenarios, he's receiving the ball with momentum, he's receiving the ball with a situation where he can build some momentum before he arrives at his man. And when he's got that momentum, he has the skill and guile and creativity to maximize that situation. Whereas when we're up against a defensive side, he receives the ball to a dead stop out on the touchline. He's got to create that momentum from a dead start. He doesn't quite have the hips and the explosivity to do that. Having said all that, I still thought he was very good against Sheffield United anyway. So certainly good enough, right? And I think that, yeah, with Kulusevski being good enough on the right and then one of Perisic or Solomon being good enough on the left, we're kind of there. But it also just shows a bit of space for an upside if that's what we want to spend money in the future on a first 11 player.
Do you think that's the obvious area of improvement for Spurs going forward? If they bring in some really elite players in those areas, is it just right, okay, Champions League football, here we come?
It's a little tough because we've now got Kulusevski, Johnson, Solomon, Perisic, Brian Hill, and also kind of Son for those positions, right? So you're moving a lot of players down a pecking order if you bring in one extra. So I guess the season provides a good opportunity to sort of explore first who within the squads can best provide those things, and then if that player is good enough anyway, right? Mm. Obviously, depth is a huge issue throughout the squad, so we have other transfer needs there. For me, yeah, I've come, such is the effect of Postecoglou on my mentality, I've come to a place where it's like, at the close of the window, I was frustrated at Tottenham. Come on, let's get, you know, Karim Mitoma, let's get Lloriente, let's get Jeremy Doku, you know, let's get a real 1v1 monster. And now I'm kind of like, I'm almost having that mystery box there is a bit exciting, because think how good we are now and think how good we could be in the future if we have that profile in the squad.
Mm. Yeah, and the wide forwards are important because they feed the centre forward. And that's been, as we've mentioned already, a bit of a question, because Richarlison started the season playing in that role. And more recently, we've seen Son moved inside as well. And there's been questions about, you know, how Ange should litigate who is going to start there. What have you made of that problem so far, Charlie?
The Richarlison
Son, yeah.
Yeah, I think I was more optimistic about Richarlison in the system than so far has been justified. I thought it would work quite well. I think ultimately it still can. I think he can be decent in it. And I think you might have to make peace with the fact that if you are playing that role, you know, kind of like how Firmino did at Liverpool, you're not always going to be the most prolific player in that team. You know, it's often the way that it's the wide forwards actually who are getting most of the goals and the headlines in a way, and you're having to do quite a lot of donkey work occupying defenders and that sort of thing. That said, yeah, I don't think he's been sort of as effective as I thought he would be. And I think the move to Son has happened. I don't think that was necessarily Postecoglou's expectation, certainly that would happen quite so soon. You know, he went in with Richarlison. I think he imagined that was how he was going to line up for a little while. And we're in a position now where Richarlison's got to kind of get that place back. And Solomon played well again against Sheffield United, because obviously, you know, he's not going to drop Son, who's the captain and, you know, you'd probably say talisman, I suppose, in Kane's absence. And they don't have the slight challenge for them as well is they don't have Europe or cup games to sort of play Richarlison back into form. He's got to do it in the Premier League. But I think he can. You know, he's had those good spells with Everton. We know he can do it. He's not shown it at Tottenham that he can score or contribute consistently. But I definitely think that's, you know, there for him. We might just have to be a bit patient, which, you know, doesn't always come naturally to football fans and media.
And, yeah, especially when strikers are involved. But, yeah. Nathan, on your most recent podcast episode, you were advocating a horses-for-courses approach to the striker situation at Spurs, where in certain games Son has played, in certain games Richarlison has played.
Yeah, I think that's the way. I've been sort of dramatically unworried about the centre-forward situation all along. There was a big deal about sort of the wake of Harry Kane and the expectation of who could possibly fill those boots. But for me, Richarlison and Son are both really, really good profile matches for what you're looking for in a Postecoglou centre-forward. The Sheffield United game showed it especially well, but I think it's been fairly clear all along that the sun is appropriate for when there's space to get in behind and the opposition coming out and pressing and trying to have the ball themselves. And Richarlison's there to be more of a battering ram against the lower blocks, although he also can move in behind, has mobility, is good with the ball at his feet, can carry the ball and stuff. So I'm really not worried at all. I think that we've got two really, really good options and we can continue to rotate them. I think the only problem we've had earlier with Richarlison was that it goes back to the previous topic at hand. We were playing Son and Kulusevski as the wingers. Son, who is trying to move into a forwards position from a wide area, and Kulusevski, who was really struggling to beat his man. Son's not really a crosser anyway. So you've got a forward who's waiting in the box for crosses and there aren't crosses coming in. So it wasn't a huge surprise to me that he wasn't converting non-chances right in those situations. But we've seen more recently when you've got Perisic on the left-hand side who can beat his man and put a good cross in, Richarlison has put a couple of goals away in a couple of games, right? So it's not a shocker to me. And I think that we get those combinations of players, right? Then we can really thrive with both forwards.
We've spent a lot of time so far talking about the players who we weren't sure were going to do well or the areas where there can be improvement. But I think the big story so far is just how many players have really enjoyed playing in Ange Postecoglou's system. So I've just got a list of players here who we could talk about. We've talked about Udogie already. We've not even really mentioned Yves Bissouma, who's had an incredible reinvention in this system. And then you've got players like, okay, James Maddison. It's not maybe that surprising that he would enjoy this kind of system. But then you've got Mickey van der Ven.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say Ricky, but it's Mickey, isn't it? Mickey van der Ven, who has been, you know, again, that's a potentially troubling spot to try and fill with a new manager coming in, etc. And he's come in and just from day one been absolutely perfect. So I'm going to leave you guys with the opportunity of deciding to, let's talk about Bissouma, because I think Bissouma was sort of languishing at Spurs under Conte. It never really worked out for him, but he's been transformed by the system, and I think a lot of people now consider him one of the best tight space technical players in world football, off the back of a pre-season and five games of Premier League football. So yeah, what have you made of Bissouma?
Yeah, he's been the one. I mean, when you were talking about the players there, I thought, yeah, we haven't mentioned him yet, and he's, you know, arguably been their best player. He's so perfect for that role. I mean, you've got to be so good to play that role, and he aligns so nicely with what Postecoglou wants. You know, he sees bravery as kind of taking the ball in tight spaces. And Bissouma will drop into the box, drop a shoulder, lose a couple of attackers. He's so confident doing that. And that really sets the tone for how Spurs are able to play. I mean, his first season was a weird one because there was all the stuff with Conte clearly not trusting him, saying he didn't appreciate, you know, he needed to improve the tactical aspects. He also had COVID right at the start. He then had a nasty injury that kept him out for months. So it was also sort of curtailed by those factors as well. It wasn't just Conte not wanting to play him. But he has been, I mean, he's just been the level. You know, I remember Brighton came to Spurs in April 2022, won 1-0. And I don't know if you remember that game, Nathan, but he was absolutely amazing. And I remember saying to Andy Naylor, who covers Brighton, I was like, every time I see Bissouma play, I just think, how is he not, with all due respect, playing for, you know, one of the, well, the richest Premier League clubs anyway. You know, one of the big boys has got to come in soon for him. And when Spurs did, I was so excited because I was like, this just seems like such a smart, logical signing. And then obviously last season happened. And maybe that sort of revised everyone's expectations and made them forget how good he'd been at Brighton. And now we're seeing just a reminder of how good he is. He is one of the most press-resistant midfielders. He's so hard to get the ball off. The way he just glide past players. I think he's going to be absolutely crucial for them.
Let's talk about Van der Ven as well.
Sure,
Because I think he's probably the other player who's had a sort of a weirdly quiet effect on the team, because it's not that you come out talking about the things that he does individually or in games, right, but never have to worry about anything that he's done wrong or anything that he's let go, really. I think there's a couple of early games where he was a little bit flaky on the back line when half space crosses were coming in against Manchester United, I think it was.
Yeah,
when
got nutmeg Bruno, by Rashford as well.
And got, yeah, and there's a few chances where Bruno Fernandes had that header and that was him sort of not dropping out of the line. I think it ended up being offside. But other than that, I just can't really think of many situations where he's put a foot wrong.
Not really. I think because you and I, John, going back a couple of years, were watching his full pitch dribbles for Volendam, right? Going, this guy's weird. What's going on with it? Why is a centre back putting up six dribbles per 90? You know,
and six full length pitch dribbles. Like, it wasn't just dribbling; he was just going from his own box to the opposition box. Insane.
Yeah, and then we got linked with this guy. Van de Ven, I'm like, oh, who's that? And I went and looked him up. I was like, oh, he's that guy who was doing all those dribbles in the Netherlands. That's crazy. How's he developing as a centre back? And I went and watched him. Went and watched some of his Wolfsburg footage, and I thought, okay, this guy is a physical freak. Like, he's huge. He's fast. He's agile. He's nimble. He's explosive. He's strong. Like, this guy is, you know, a cyborg. And I said, okay, here's these moments where Wolfsburg have put him in a difficult position and he's not quite read the game perfectly. And sometimes because of his physical aspects, he's overly confident in a 1v1 situation. And he just assumes if the player turns, I'll just turn faster than him. And he actually gets burnt a couple of times. And I went, okay, here's a player with tools, really good tools for a high line. But he has some sort of rough areas. He's going to probably take a while to iron those out. But once again, things have just clicked instantly. And Spurs have done a good job of defending as a unit. And obviously that helps him. But I think the circumstances, the way that Spurs play, where you say, hey, Van de Ven, you're responsible for this 30 by 30 meter area behind you. And he's just going to master that every time, because that's what he's, again, designed in the lab to do.
I feel like there's so many other players we could spend time talking about here, but we simply do not have the time. So if you want to find out more about Spurs, obviously check out Charlie's writing at The Athletic, View from the Lane podcast, Nathan's stuff over at The Extra Inch, and they will tell you, they'll fill you in on all of the details of the players who've been doing really well. But let's move on to the final section where we start thinking about the future. So we've talked about mainly the good stuff so far, and I think you referenced it before, Charlie. It's obviously, you know, there is going to become a period of struggle, and I wondered what you have seen so far from Ange's Spurs that makes you think this could be a problem in the future. Has it simply not arrived yet, or do you think that there are some inklings of what that could be?
I mean, I guess Saturday against Sheffield United was gave sort of weight to either argument for or against how Spurs are going to do against low blocks, because, you know, up until the 98th minute they were losing 1-0, and it looked like being one of those really frustrating afternoons where they actually hadn't really done it. Yes, they had created enough chances, but it wasn't one where you were coming off it being like, wow, their goalkeeper's an absolute blinder. You know, if they'd lost 1-0, I think you'd have had to have said it's not a travesty. Obviously, they did come back to win. So you could say, well, you know, we're good against low blocks. I think that's going to be really interesting as the season goes on, because Spurs are good now again. So that's what happens. You know, you're going to have teams coming and doing that. And I remember with Pochettino's Tottenham, there was a little bit of a lag maybe with them once they became good and teams became wise to how good they were, sitting really deep. And initially, Spurs finding that quite hard, and there were some frustrating afternoons and evenings in there. So I think that's going to be a challenge. I guess the other as well is, you know, they do leave themselves open. It's high risk, high reward. And I just think there will be days, be that against one of the best, in inverted commas, teams in the league, or against a team who are just, you know, really good on the counter or that sort of thing, where they do look, they are left a bit exposed, but that's kind of baked in to what Postecoglou's doing. I think there'll be an acceptance of that from the fan base, because generally it is so enjoyable to watch.
So West Ham is the worry, yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. It could be that sort of, yeah, like what happened to Brighton against West Ham. You know, I think there could be a match or matches like that where you just have to hold your hands up and say, yeah, that can happen. You know, it happened to Brighton, it can happen to us.
What about you?
Yeah, I think the low block is where, again, that 1v1 specialist would make that more of a sure thing. But I feel pretty good about how he played against Sheffield United, getting the goals eventually. And then also the second half against Brentford also was a low block, and we just churned out the sort of lesser quality chances over a period of time to get the point in that game. I think I've been so impressed with our sort of on-the-fly tactical adaptations to teams pressing us high. So Man United man marks the inverted fullbacks, and we switch to moving our fullbacks into wide areas, splitting the centre-backs wider. Bournemouth went very heavy on man-to-man marking, and we lent heavy into our individual 1v1 ability and turned that strength into a weakness, or a weakness into a strength, as it were. Burnley set up to invite the pass over to Pedro Porro and then sent Sander Berger over to him as he received the ball and turned the ball over a couple of times there. And then we started utilising that as an opportunity to send the ball long to Son, who was 1v1. And this isn't even like changes made at half time. This is stuff being done on the fly, you know, 20 minutes, 15 minutes into a game. Really, really impressive stuff to overcome high pressing sides. Again, low blocks I'm fairly happy with. The only place where I feel like we've struggled, and I think anyone's going to struggle here, is you saw in the first half against Man United, you saw in the first half against Sheffield United, where there's been more of a medium block, where they've stood off our centre-backs and they've marked the full-backs, they've marked the midfielders, they've used wing-backs most often, although not in Manchester United's case, against the wingers, and they just sort of slowed the game down and disrupted our build-up play. That for me is the only real tactical challenge, but again I think that's going to slow most teams down and be frustrating and probably also going to exhaust the team who's defending that style over time. And of course you're always eventually going to trip up against a low block, right? I said on the extra inch the other day that like Man City are the best team ever against a low block. They still trip up a couple of times a season because that's just how, you know, the natural statistical variance in finishing and the way the ball bounces when it spins funny sometimes, you know?
Yeah, and Ange Postecoglou's obviously had a lot of practice against low blocks for Celtic. And, you know, that's a really, that's not a glib comment from me, that, you know, he's had a lot of experience of having to work out how to break down these low blocks. So yeah, I think that all stands in Spurs at least in good stead. It's obviously too early to make an assessment on how Spurs season will go five games in, so I'm not going to push you for predictions, but I guess I'm sort of interested to hear from you both what you want to see from Spurs in order to make your mind up about what level they're at. And that's a continuation of the previous question to an extent, but you mentioned before, Charlie, that the next couple of games are big games. We've got the North London derby, which will have happened by the time this comes out, so feel free to say something that looks very silly in a couple of days' time. But we've also got a game against Liverpool coming up as well, which, you know, a lot of these games I think are really nice acid tests for where both of these teams are at, and they're going to, you know, they're going to change the narrative. We saw Manchester United losing to Arsenal, changing that narrative quite considerably as well. So yeah, I'll start with you, Charlie. What are you thinking about in terms of like the level that you expect this team to be sort of competing at by the end of the season?
It is really interesting, because I know there's been a lot of sort of jokey but semi-serious chat on Twitter of like, you know, could we maybe, you know, even go on a title push, which, yeah, I think most people would say that's ludicrous. But I do remember this time last year, Arsenal won their first five games, and there was a similar kind of debate, you know, people saying, God, could Arsenal be in the title race? And obviously most people were like, no, obviously not. Now, they were coming from a position of having been fifth the previous season and had a manager for a couple of years, were building towards something. Obviously, this is different. Spurs were eighth last season, Postecoglou's first season. Were they to win both of those games? But that's an enormous if. Then I think then maybe you can start thinking about, you know, we can really, really dream. As it is, I think, you know, even if they were to lose both those games, I think ultimately what will probably decide their season is games against teams who are going to sit deep against them, because that's going to be the majority of the matches, and how well can they deal with those challenges. You know, you can easily get top four or five, but losing games to, you know, title challenging teams or whatever, that doesn't really decide it either way. At the moment, I feel like that, you know, given the Champions League, we think will be top five for next season, to get into next season's Champions League. I think that's probably where I think they're going to be sort of pushing for. But it, you know, it does change so quickly, and it will only take a few bad results for us then to be probably rewriting this period and saying, oh well, actually they haven't really played anyone good, and if you look at this, da, da, da. So yeah, but that's kind of where I'm at right now.
So top five, yeah, aimable.
Yeah, definitely. I think analysing the sort of strength of schedule we've had so far, like, I reckon Man United will probably finish top half when all is said and done, right? But what I mean by that is I think that we have had some decent challenges. I talked about some of the tactical shapes that the opposition have thrown at us. I don't think we've had any easy games, to be honest. and adapted well on the fly again to each of those. I think essentially what we've seen here is how good things can be, like a sample of the upside of how things are going when things are going, but the squad depth isn't there, right? Mm-hmm. Arguably, we can't afford an injury to our goalkeeper, either of our centre-backs, Eze Bissouma.
Madison?
Madison has Lo Celso as backup. Personally, I'm happy with that. Maybe that wouldn't be the consensus among Spurs fans. I think we have two good forwards and a bunch of good options on the wings. But that's a number, you know, an injury, a suspension. Bissouma's going to go to AFCON at some point, and so Sarr, by the way. And some will have the Asian Games. So the other thing, obviously, other than just directly, we could lose a player for a number of games, and that could break the system, which is what we saw against Fulham in the League Cup, is that also there's like a periodization element there, right? Can all these players play the whole season? Well, without European football, maybe we don't have sort of a low fitness curve through the midpoint of the season, but maybe we do. So I think we've got a really good glimpse of what's to come, but we now have to sort of pad the squad out to make that something that we can sustain over a season.
I think that is just before, you know, we spoke about the how good a window it is. I do think, again, that will be coloured by what happens injury-wise, because they've left themselves, there's no question, Spurs have left themselves in a position where they either need to get lucky or not get unlucky in certain positions. And if Romero picks up an injury over the weekend and is out for a period, or Van de Ven, then I think suddenly everyone is slating that window because...
Yeah.
Because it's Eric Dier and
Ashley Phillips.
Yeah.
Or Ben Davis can come across.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's not much there.
Mm. Well, that's the short-term future of this season. I guess let's end by thinking a little bit about the longer-term future. Postecoglou has talked about wanting to make Spurs into a perennially winning team. Do we think that's a possibility, five games in?
I think it's a possibility, yeah. I think it's... certainly the best chance Spurs have had to really build something over a longer period since Pochettino left. I don't think Mourinho, Nuno or Conte were particularly thinking in a medium to long term way.
I think that with the quality of coaching, both on a sort of meta-tactical level and an individual maximisation level, our improved talent ID that we've seen this summer, a clearer picture of how to build the squad and the improved revenue that Tottenham have achieved over the last two decades, that is basically a certainty.
Great. Well, a happy Spurs pod. Who would have known it? But I do have to bring proceedings to a close. I could have talked for much longer with you both. I really enjoyed the section where we talked about philosophy, actually. But yeah, the time has come to a close. So, Charlie, thank you so much for coming on. Your work is available on The Athletic. You also are on the View from the Lane podcast, and you can be found at Twitter at CD Eccleshare. And Nathan, as we've said, your work is found on the Extra Inch podcast. Do go and check them out. And you are on Twitter at Nathan A. Clark. Thank you both so much for coming on today.